Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Jonathan Bennett joins me. We're going to be talking about interactive fiction. You're going to be in a maze made of twisty passages all alike. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Jonathan Bennett. Episode 408, recorded October 18th, 2016. Interactive fiction. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Braintree. Mobile app development can be complex, but integrating your payments no longer has to be. With Braintree, your business can accept nearly every type of payment from any device with just one integration. Learn more at BraintreePayments.com/floss. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects you may be using every day and unaware of it, projects you may want to go play with right after this show. I bet today is going to be one of those. Joining me this week is Jonathan Bennett. Welcome back to the show, Jonathan.
Thanks. It's good to be here, as always.
Awesome, awesome. And although a little behind the scenes, we actually had Guillermo scheduled for today, but he is sick. Luckily, Jonathan, you stepped into the last second. I always appreciate that. And where are we speaking now? That's backwards. Where are you speaking to us from?
I'm here in the home office, corporate headquarters in Lawton, Oklahoma.
Awesome, awesome. And I hear you have traffic lights in your town, which is a good thing.
Yes, just big enough to have traffic lights.
Okay, great, great, great. And I am speaking to you from just north of Olympia, Washington, staying in my brother's place through the holidays so we can enjoy each other's company and all that sort of stuff. And I just finished a moving experience, 6 years in one place, now in another place, from one spare bedroom from one friend to another spare bedroom of another friend. Since I don't need much place in Portland, I just need a place to come home and store the Drobo. So that's pretty much all I've got there. But this isn't This Week in Randall's Geography. This is Floss Weekly. So let's take a look at who we have on today. We're going to be talking about interactive fiction. If the phrase "you're in a maze of twisty little passages all alike" means anything to you, you're going to really enjoy today's show, because we have a couple of people who are heavily involved in the Interactive Fiction Technology Foundation. We have Jason McIntosh and Deborah Kaplan, who are going to talk to us about interactive fiction in general and about some specific projects that they've got going on related to this, including a sort of a preview of a show we're going to be doing probably 6 or 7 weeks from now about some interactive fiction creation software named Twine. But I don't want to give away the whole show. This is what I was able to get from it from looking at their website for a few minutes. Jonathan, what do you know about this so far?
Basically nothing. I will be learning along with our audience today. This is one of the results of jumping in at the last minute. I've not gotten a lot of chance to review this. What it does bring to mind, though, is the old choose your own adventure books that I remember reading when I was a kid. So I'm curious if they have some of that vibe going on, or if it's more the old school Zork and the adventure games, stuff like that. So I will be learning as well.
Well, I think they would actually put all of that in the terminology for interactive fiction, as to whether it's implemented by maybe playing cards in front of you, or maybe by a computer program, or, as you mentioned, the Choose Your Own Adventure books. I remember playing with one of those. But again, my initial interaction with interactive fiction was, in fact, The Great Colossal Adventure, but everybody called it Adventure, many, many decades ago. And I remember cheating at it. I should save this for the guests. I should save this for the guests, because they'll enjoy this story and I want to get their reaction as well. But before we go on, I have a very important message, if I can find the right tab on my browser. Yes, because This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Braintree. By next year, maybe even next week, there could be a whole new way to pay. Maybe it will be the next Bitcoin or the next Apple Pay or even both. Fortunately, Braintree's full-stack payment platform is easily adaptable to whatever the future holds, so you can adapt easily too. Accept everything from pounds to PayPal to that next big innovation from any device with just one integration. And when that next new payment method comes along, all you have to do is update a few lines of code. No late nights, no complicated recoding, no stress about staying ahead of the curve. Braintree Payments is here to help. They have simple and secure payments code you can integrate quickly. The Braintree code supports Android, iOS, and JavaScript clients. That's cool. SDKs in 7 languages, .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, yay Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby. They're all in code with clear documentation. So Braintree gives you an easy way to accept multiple payment types with one integration. Integrating it into your app is as easy as inserting a few lines of code. Learn more at BraintreePayments.com/floss. And we thank Braintree for sponsorship of this show. Now let's go ahead and bring on our guest, Jason McIntosh. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Randall. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for having me on.
And where are you speaking to us from?
I am speaking to you from my 10x11 office here in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island.
Newport, Rhode Island, the smallest state with the biggest name. I like that piece of trivia, so I have driven through there a couple of times. And boy, it didn't take long. You blink, you miss Rhode Island. It's kind of small. Okay,
pretty much.
Let's also go ahead and bring on Deborah. Deborah Kaplan, welcome to the show.
Hello, I'm happy to be here.
Great. And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm speaking to you from outside of Cambridge, Massachusetts, in the greater MIT tech bubble.
Great. Cambridge, our fair city. That's the only way I know what that means. I think there's some institution there, some large educational institution.
One or two, nothing important.
All right, cool. All right, great. Well, let's go back to Jason to start this off. So, how well did I describe interactive fiction, and how did this foundation get started?
Well, you were starting to hint about how interactive fiction. It sounded like you have personal experience in its roots in the 1970s and 80s, playing Colossal Cave, aka Adventure, the game after which the entire all games that followed have taken their name. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of the gist of it. Also, the tradition of Choose Your Own Adventure and other game books absolutely ties into it as well. So this is a form of interactive literature, crossed with video games and such, that does have these as its roots. So yeah, you've basically got the gist of it that way. And what IFTF does, the Interactive Fiction Technology Foundation, that is a nonprofit, charitable nonprofit that myself and a few colleagues from the Boston area mostly started only this year in order to support various technologies and services and events that the community that has basically continued and continued to support and invent and explore new directions in IF, as we call it. So this community has basically existed since the 1990s, So IF sort of had its commercial heyday in the 70s and 80s. A lot of people, maybe your age and mine, will remember Infocom, which basically dominated the computer games market especially in the early 80s. That sort of faded out, and an amateur movement started initially around the Usenet era and such in the 1990s. That sort of revived this, and that began a number of technologies and online archives and discussion forums and programming languages and other goodies that allow people to create and share and foster new directions in IF. This has been basically an entire a loose collection of technologies and services for the last two decades. IFTF's role is basically to throw some organization and financial support and legal protection around this for the first time. So that's what we were doing. We just started this year, and we have we're starting with three programs that support the interactive fiction competition, which is an annual event that's been hosted since 1995, and Twine, which you mentioned in the intro, which is a traditional FLOSS project that is one of the more popular contemporary IF creation toolkits, and also a project to investigate and report on the state of accessibility in IF, which Deborah can speak to. So that is our initial three public programs that we're rolling out with.
Well, Jason, we're almost out of time, so I want to thank you for coming on the show today.
No, just thanks kidding. A lot. Really happy to talk, as you know.
They let anybody do this show.
You can break in at any time, by the way. I mean, I could just sit here talking.
I like really long answers because it gives me time to kind of regroup and think about what I was going to ask next. And I think where I want to go first with this is – I imagine that much of our audience, being the tykes that they are, think of games and they immediately think of first-person shooters. But we're sort of, when we're talking about interactive fiction, we're talking about the other end of the spectrum. What are you doing when you're interacting with one of these games that makes it so different from, say, a shoot 'em up?
I'm glad you asked. So another hat that I wear is as the organizer of the IF Comp, the Interactive Fiction Competition. Like I said, that's been going on since the 90s. I've been its organizer since 2014. And for its website, I can actually cruise over there right now and read off of the... So in answer to the question, what is IF? The answer I use is IF Comp entries are video games whose player interactions center on text. So if the main way that the game is communicating with you is text on a screen, that doesn't mean it is text and nothing else. It can be a multimedia experience. It can mix in sounds and timing and animation. But if its main facet is text and the main way that you interact with the game is pushing text back at it one way or another, whether that is typing in commands in the what we might call the old school Zork style, or whether that is selecting hyperlinks to choose how you want the program to continue, it's all about text. And that is the main differentiator between what we call interactive fiction and what we call every other kind of video game.
Wow. Okay. So, I think there's probably some people at home going, what do you mean text? How do you, fire. Is that what you're saying? I mean, how do you interact with this? So, let's take adventure, since that actually is the one that I'm most familiar with. One of the things that shocked me when I finally read through the source code of it was that it really only had noun, verb, and sometimes just noun as the entire realm of input. How could you possibly have a game with that little interaction?
So you're talking about what we today call Parser IF, and that is aka text adventure games that yeah. continues to be a very rich vein of very obscure games. Although it was less obscure 30 years ago. But essentially the way that, to use your concrete example, we can talk about Adventure, aka Colossal Cave. The way that that works is, so you play an adventurer and you are in a discrete setting. You are an explorer, in this underground realm, and you are seeking treasures. And so the game has a map, just like a first-person shooter has a map. But rather than maneuver the map by tilting a joystick around to move your character and then tilting another joystick around to move your camera, you move around the map by typing text commands. And in this case, you would type go north or enter the house or open the grate and then go down. Actually, if you type in exactly that, you would get a parser error, which gets into the question of how cranky the parser is. But that's another story. You would type open the grate, return. And then you would, the game would respond by saying, I certainly don't have all the game's responses memorized, but it might say something like, you strain your muscles and the gate creaks open. It's something like a dungeon master to push the nerd factor down by one level. If you can think of it as a ideally it works as an interactive story where you tell the game what you want to do, and then the game says, oh, well, you do this, and then this happens, and now a passageway opens, and then you can type in enter the passageway, and then the game says, oh, you enter the dark passageway, but it's too dark to see anything here, and you might be eaten by a Gru. So then you might say, take inventory, which is adventure game ease for what am I carrying? And then it says, oh, you have an unlit torch. And the game continues on from there, ideally.
Right, right. Obviously, you're stirring the memories of many people who have actually played this, all three of them in my audience, but probably a lot more than I think, because this was sort of formative in the early days of what do we do? And if not that era of games, the whole Infocom series, Zork, and I remember Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I think, was part of their series.
Absolutely.
Things like that. Now, what is the interactive fiction, what is IFTF doing to preserve, I guess not really preserve the actual games, but preserve the sort of culture that this is? What are your projects? What are you trying to get involved in? And as we get more into looking at the IFComp, in fact, Deborah, why don't you answer this question? What is IFTF doing to help preserve this culture?
Well, I mean, Jason's a better person to answer this question than I am, but I mean, I think I want to throw this one back to Jason, and I'll focus on the stuff that is my expertise, which is the accessibility part.
Sorry, Jason, I tried.
we will absolutely get back to the accessibility soon, I'm sure, because that is a very important question, and it's actually one of the most important aspects of IF, just by the fact it's built out of text. It is one of the most accessible video game styles that there is. But to answer your question in a frustratingly oblique manner, before I talk about IFTF, because IFTF is quite a young organization, the reason IF is still as, to use a different definition of the word accessible as it is through the efforts of many hobbyists and other passionate people who love this weird kind of video game over the decades, who have made these amazing services like the IF Archive, which you can find at ifarchive.org. And that is essentially a collection, a browsable collection of everything that people who love interactive fiction can find that is ever IF related. And it is just this amazingly massive public archive. There's a front end to that called the IFDB, which is run by Mike Roberts. That is at ifdb.tads.org. That is exactly what it sounds like. It's a web-based front end of every IF game you can imagine and meta information to help you play them. And its efforts, I name all this stuff because it's efforts like these run by passionate individuals that have allowed this relatively continuing to be obscure type of art to continue to stay alive and relevant and continue to grow in new directions even after the sort of commercial spotlight, like decades after the commercial spotlight is no longer on it. Which is really important. And IFTF's goal, coming back to your actual question, is, again, to look at all these amazing, essentially hobbyist, amateur, and I mean amateur in the sense that no one's making any money off of this, efforts, and throw some organization and protection around it and see how we can just make sure that this stuff stays around and is preserved for the indefinite future.
Well, one of the things that I used to think of when I was playing these interactive fiction games is like my brother Russ was huge into role-playing games like GURPS and Dungeons & Dragons. And of course, every time I'd mention D&D, he goes, no, we're way beyond that now. We don't do that anymore. but he would be into all these different things. And to me, there's definitely a culture of that. But part of what I see interactive fiction as is sort of an automated dungeon master. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah. it's essentially a typically IF. It's not always. There are certainly multiplayer experiments. I've even written one myself. But it's typically a single player experience where this is how it crosses over with software and Floss, is a writer slash programmer has created this amazing, delicate, often in the best cases, thoroughly play tested and beta tested machine for you, and has laid it in front of you and has invited you to explore it. And when it's working at its best, it is like a truly magical experience, in that you're having this communication, you're having this conversation with the author, very much in the same way that when you're reading a transcendently amazing novel or book, and you feel like you're really connecting with the author. You can have that experience with IF, but in a way that is unique to an actually interactive, I am typing something and I'm getting something back experience.
Well, and that just occurred to me then. So as natural language recognition gets better, are these interactive fictions? I almost called it a game, sorry.
I call them games. Good.
I was hoping not to be it's like you never call it sci-fi because all the SF people get really mad.
No,
so
not everyone agrees with me. A lot of people prefer to call them works, but I call them games on the IF Comp website. And the door hasn't been knocked down by the game police to correct me on this. So
All right. So I'm thinking though that back to the question. So as natural language parsing gets better, are the interfaces to these things getting better, and does that make more burden for the creator to then have more possible responses for things?
The short answer, listen to me. So that is a very interesting question, and it gets to the point that parser-based IF is very hard to do well because typically, how does the game begin? It says, okay, here's some text, and then here's a prompt. Go ahead and type something. What a important critic of the medium, Emily Short, herself a very storied IF author and the author of many works, and now writes a column called If Only or IF Only for Rock Paper Shotgun. I think that is the correct website. Once called the command prompt, the DOS style, the ancient command prompt that Parser IF still uses, a false promise, because it implies that you can type anything and the computer will magically understand you, and that is a dirty lie. There is basically a standard that you have to learn in order to play these games that is every bit as complicated as learning how to use a modern 2-joystick, 58-button video game controller, for example. And that puts kind of a accessibility cap, again, using the sort of outreach definition of the word accessibility, in that if you put a new player down, you say, this game is great, you should play it. And they'll type like, okay, who am I? And then the game will say, I don't know what you just said. Because it was expecting you to type inventory or examine me or other things that are in this expected tight verb set. And then they get bored and they go play Doom instead or whatever. Natural language processing, it's no matter how good that gets, these games are still difficult to take to anticipate everything the player might possibly do and have a meaningful response to that in order to keep the player engaged. There is one of the games that I would recommend that just does such an amazing job of this, in that it front loads in the first few turns everything you might possibly do and allows you to do it. This is the game that whenever I teach IF in a classroom setting, I always roll out if I'm getting into Parser IF. And it also works well in a live setting for like live audience-based playthroughs. It's a game from, I think, the 2007 IF competition by an author named Admiral Hota called Lost Pig. And that is a game where the player character is an orc who is a farmhand, and you have lost your boss's pig, and you have to explore an underground environment, kind of a throw. It's an intentional throwback to Zork and Colossal Cave, but instead of looking for treasure, you're looking for this pig. And in the first move, I often hint the students and say, a typical first thing you do is you type inventory to see what you're carrying, or you type examine me. And so they're, all right, let's do that. And it says, so your orc's name is Grunk, and he talks in orkies, and he'll say something like, Grunk is carrying a torch and is wearing pants. Literally 100% of the time, the students will say, take off the pants. And I say, okay, drop pants. And the game will say, okay, Grunk naked now. And the students just completely go berserk, because that's not how video games are supposed to work. They don't actually allow you to actually do what you want. You can only walk around and shoot things. What's going on here? This makes no sense. And then they panic and they say, set fire to the pants. And then Grunk says, okay, pants burning now. Grunk like fire. And they go and they just start rolling around in the aisles because, like, what even is this? What's happening? But that's a game that just took so long for the creator to make, because he cared so much about leading the player to make certain choices by really excellent use of props and, if I might say, stagecraft and wording. And then saying, and then if the player thinks that they're being clever, actually get in front of them and have a response. That's hard. There are very few. And that's part of why really amazing Parser IF games are frankly few. And that's why we do events like the Interactive Fiction Competition in order to encourage their creation. And only a few come out every year, but they are memorable and amazing when done right.
Well, I want to come back to this topic in a second, but I do want to give Deborah a chance to chat at least a little bit here. So accessibility, what that word means to me right away is like, okay, if I'm staring at a PS3 screen and it's a first-person shooter, I can't imagine if I was, sight challenged. I don't know what the proper terminology is anymore, but if I couldn't see the screen. I imagine that would be a difficult game to play. So that's obviously at the wrong end of the spectrum for someone who is sight challenged. So how does interactive fiction help with that? And what's that like?
So to start with, there are ways that people with a variety of disabilities. So blindness, being blind or vision impaired, is actually one of the rarest disabilities out there. There's a huge slew of relevant disabilities that affect gameplay and computer use in general. Blindness and low vision, other vision impairments such as dyslexia, red-green color blindness, as you can imagine, can affect standard gameplay. But sure. Deafness, limited hand mobility, severe arthritis, anything that involves hand issues, which is actually me. I actually have a hard time playing games because I have a severe mobility problems with my hands. But, you know, deafness, but also people with limited short-term memory or people who are non-neurotypical or who have anxiety disorders, all of these can be affected by different types of gameplay. And I do want to say first that most computer games can be played by a wider variety of people with disabilities than you would expect. And to give a shout out to another nonprofit, the folks at Able Gamers, which is a great newish nonprofit, do a lot of work, first of all, helping people with disabilities adapt controllers and do other things to make it so that they can play traditional video games. And they've also put out a guide to help game designers make their games accessible, and to encourage people not to think of putting in one of the problems is that there are easy options to add to games, which because of sort of the competitiveness around video games, a lot of people think, well, you can't add an ability to take out to take out real-time combat, because then it's all unfair and unequal. But of course you can. You just adjust your leaderboards accordingly. You know, there's no reason to say everything has to be time limited. Everything has to be real time. You just say, well, if your leaderboards are based on real time combat, then if you turn off the real time combat ability, then maybe that's going to be a different leaderboard. So the folks at Able Gamers do a fantastic amount of work with that. But as Jason has implied, and as you've sort of spoken to, interactive fiction is much, much easier to sort of automatically and natively, in theory, be accessible, not just for people who are blind or have vision impairments, because they already have tools that, screen readers, for example, or screen magnifiers, which will increase the size of the text or read the text out loud to them, but for people with mobility impairments, you know, if you're a computer user who can't type or can't use a mouse or can't use a joystick, if you're a computer user at all, you already have some other kind of adaptive tech which will let you put text on a screen and take text away from a screen. That's actually the sort of most fundamental thing that adaptive tech will do, is it will help you get text off a screen into some other format, whether it's Braille or spoken or, you know, larger. And it will help you put text into a screen, whether it's via SIP and puff tube or screen speech recognition, something like that. So already, in theory, interactive fiction is already really, really ready for people with disabilities. And because of that, it actually has a fairly broad audience of people who have disabilities. There's a lot of mobility impaired or blind or vision impaired users who are already very, very happy to use interactive fiction games and play interactive fiction games, because you don't, if it's done right and accessibly, you actually don't need anything special. It's not time constrained. It doesn't involve color. It doesn't require sight. It doesn't require a mobility. And something that Jason sort of addressed but didn't discuss directly is, because of that parser-based interactive fiction is so difficult, there have been a lot of advances, taking advantage of advances in web technology, especially in interactive fiction in the last years. And those advances have not necessarily incorporated accessible best practices, because of just lack of knowledge, not because of, you know, let's keep the blind people out. But and because of that, it's really important, because of this audience for whom accessibility is so vital and who are already a passionate, passionate players and passionate creators of interactive fiction games. You need to make sure that as you do advances in IF, you need to make sure that those advances take accessibility best practices into account.
Well, I was poking around at a couple of the entries in the IFComp, and I went in preparation for today's show, and I had not seen a web-based game before, where you're presented with essentially a page of text, and there are a few key words highlighted because they're links to the next page. If I were to build something like that, is there anything I need to think of above and beyond to make it more accessible? I mean, this is clearly something that I'm not thinking enough about.
Actually, yes. And this is where the work that we're doing comes into play. One of the things that happens with a lot of modern web design, and you should listen to this, all of you listeners out there, even if you never plan on building a interactive fiction game, if you're ever doing anything with HTML and JavaScript, modern HTML with JavaScript can be 100% accessible, but you have to do certain things that most people don't know about. There's not a lot of awareness. So one thing that happens with interactive fiction games, as with a lot of modern websites, is that you, instead of just using old school HTML like it's 1999, people use JavaScript to put page elements on the page, sometimes entirely replacing HTML elements. So instead of having an anchor or a button, they take a div and they just act on that div, and they tell, you know, they use JavaScript to make the div act like a button or act like a link. And if you, which is okay, but HTML is natively accessible. The World Wide Web Consortium does a ton of work to make sure that HTML and CSS are natively accessible. Mm-hmm. But JavaScript is not. JavaScript does not have all of those functionality built in. And if you're going to use JavaScript to do anything complex, any kind of dynamic page, there's a couple of things you have to do, which are small, but you have to do them. So, for example, if you create a link or a button without using native HTML, you have to specifically give it the role button, is role equals button, role equals link, and you have to put it in the tab order. Go to one of the great ways to find out if a web page, an IF game, or anything else is going to be accessible is to put your mouse or your touchpad to the side and just try to tab around. And can you do everything the website asks you to do without touching your mouse or your touchpad? And if the answer is no, then it's not accessible. Because, like I said earlier, most adaptive tech sort of functionally, not entirely, this is an oversimplification, but it sort of functionally says, I'm going to pretend I'm a keyboard, and then I'm going to pretend I'm a screen. So what a lot of the newer IF technologies have done is they've said, well, we're going to do this cool stuff with JavaScript, and if you're doing that cool stuff with JavaScript, you have to remember, all right, now I'm going to make this a button. I'm going to make this a link. I'm going to do all of these things. The other aspect of that is that for screen reader users, so that first aspect, keyboard accessibility, that is important to screen reader users, and it's also important to mobility impaired users. This next one is basically for screen reader users only. If there's text that appears on the screen with JavaScript, instead of, okay, now HTML, you've done a link, you go to a new page, but, oh, okay, now we're opening a div and we're adding it to the DOM, we're changing from visibility hidden, you're taking off visibility hidden, something like that. If you're adding text to the page with JavaScript, the screen reader won't necessarily know you've done that. So I actually recently accessibility tested one of the entries in the IF comp. And one of the big things that we had to work around to figure out how to make it work was that it was one of these games where, I don't know if you played any of these when you were going through, but there is no DOS style prompt. It's all links, and you click on the links and things happen. And one of the things we discovered when I tested it with a screen reader was that you would click on the link, and I would know as a sighted person that text had appeared on the screen. But this screen reader, nothing would happen. It would be completely silent. So we had to come up with the best way to alert the screen reader that, hey, something has changed, and you can announce it now. The screen has changed. Now, all of this is actually, again, it's really simple. One of the World Wide Web Consortium technologies is a thing called WAI Area, which stands for Web Accessibility Initiative, Accessible Rich Internet Applications, I believe. I'm never sure with long acronyms. Yeah. But AREA gives you this great vocabulary that to basically say something new is changing. So we basically said, all right, let's consider this an alert box. Let's sort of just treat this new text that's appearing as if it's an alert box. And on an alert, your adaptive technology automatically knows how to speak all of these W3. Well, actually, it's not even that the adaptive tech knows how to speak these W3C technologies. It's that basically the browser has an accessibility tree. It adds language to the accessibility tree. The browsers speak to the accessibility APIs of your operating system. Whether you're using a screen reader like JAWS on Windows, whether you're using VoiceOver on your Mac or on your iPhone, whatever you're using, it knows how to do the communication. So once you're using these standard W3C technologies, it all just works. So you just add these tiny little snippets of code, and then the screen reader does the right thing. So one of the things that we would like to do, most people don't just sit down, Jason can tell me if I'm wrong, but I believe most people don't just sit down and write an interactive fiction game in Perl. They don't just sit down like, I'm going to write a whole game. They use an existing framework, and there's tools such as Twine that make it easier that are basically interactive fiction game writing tools. And so one of the things we want to do is say, all right, well, when these tools create web-based game experiences. Let's make it so that only one person needs to worry about it, namely the developer of the tool, or, you know, the developers of the tool, and not so that every single game creator needs to worry about these things.
Yeah, that's it's, you know, I bet we could do a full hour just on accessibility now that I keep listening to it. But I want to add in one side comment for that, and that is that accessibility is sort of riding in a parallel path and with some overlap with people who are building SEO for their pages, in the sense that I used to tell people for many years, still tell people, that the most important browser that's going to come to your website is Google. Because if you don't have a website that builds itself in a standard way with HTML, and particularly in the things you're talking about, the W3C's recommendations for accessibility, then Google won't be able to read your page and you lose out on searchability. Are you finding that you can sell accessibility by also talking about alternative browsing environments and even things like SEO here?
So there's actually a big conflict in the accessibility community about whether or not that's an appropriate way to sell it. Some people really do still like to sell it that way, but there is an argument that let's not oversell that because that will account for some accessibility and not the rest. And if we just say, well, accessibility improves SEO, then there's always the chance that people sit down and say, all right, well, how much does it improve SEO? And, you know, is it really as good as this other thing that will improve SEO? And there's aspects of accessibility that aren't improved, although certainly some, like having good image descriptions and having video captions, those are huge aspects of it. One thing that is important is that 19.4% of the U.S. Population, according to the most recent census, has a disability. Like, that's like one in five people. Now, most of those disabilities are not necessarily going to affect computer use. And in fact, one of the reasons that it often doesn't come into play in discussions of accessibility at people who are creating software is that that one in five people disproportionately live in poverty, not surprisingly. And are much less likely to be, you know, buying your latest incredibly fancy widget now that, you know, you're, oh my God, we put all this work into the thing, let's make sure it's accessible. Well, that one in five people is actually disproportionately likely to be poor. But that being said, that's still a lot of people. And I'm not actually sure of the numbers of what number of those people have accessibility needs with computers. I mean, obviously, I walk with a cane is not necessarily going to affect my ability to use a computer. It will affect the computer game that I'm playing if the computer game is Dance Dance Revolution, but it won't affect most computer use. But it is a lot of people. And here's another fact which often gets lost, and this is important to us. We are the computer game generation. We're getting older, and it's important to remember, if we're lucky, we will all be disabled one day. Because that's what happens when you get old, is that your hands get stiff. You can't move as quickly. You can't think as quickly. You can't see as well. You can't hear as well. And if we're lucky, we will all gain disabilities because we will all live long enough to have them. And while maybe the generations before us, when they got old, they continued playing bridge or pinochle, in the senior day center, I'm assuming that what we're going to want to do in our senior day centers is play Settlers of Catan and Skyrim. I mean, I'm just going out on a limb here and thinking we're not going to suddenly develop the desire to play Pinochle just because we've turned 70. So, and not just, Skyrim and Settlers of Catan. There's also a group doing some really good work with accessibility in board games, actually. We're also going to want to keep using the web. This is our world. We live on it. We're going to keep wanting to keep using computers and smartphones. We're going to want to keep programming. So that increasing disability that all people get as they get older is also going to affect this group, which is 100% tied to computers as a way of life and 100% tied to technology as a way of life. And that actually, and this is what comes to play when you're selling it, it actually has a fair amount of money. Actually talking about people who are disabled now sometimes doesn't work so well. I mean, now with interactive fiction, it's a different story because you're not worried about return on investment. This is a group of hobbyists who love a thing they're doing, and they want to reach the audience of people who love the thing they're doing. And so it's actually much easier to talk to interactive fiction people about accessibility because you don't actually have to convince anyone who's holding a wallet.
Deborah, I wanted to follow up with a couple of questions here. So hearing you describe what it takes to make the accessibility work, particularly for interactive fiction, or I guess websites in general, it sounds to me like what we need to do is load up our websites in something like the old text-based links browser. And if it works fine there, probably everybody can get to it. Is that how that goes?
That used to be one of the things people said. Links doesn't handle JavaScript, and you can do JavaScript accessibly. E-links might do some JavaScript, but it doesn't do a ton. But that absolutely used to be the argument people made. The equivalent of doing it now is the first easiest thing to do is move around your website without using a mouse. And then the second thing is, all right, now turn off style sheets. although that's also not true because most adaptive tech understands style sheets these days. Mm-hmm. But if you can... The absolute easiest thing is move around a website without using a mouse. And if you can do that, then you've got some minimal baseline. Images are a separate story, but
I'm humored because I have memories of working on some Linux server somewhere without a GUI installed and needing to look something up on Google to find out how to do something or other, and having to use the links browser and trying to Google and then get to somebody's blog to find out how to fix whatever problem it was. And I remember this. I guess the feeling is basically that of having some sort of disability and using the internet because of the situation I was in. And so that's what brought that to mind. I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
So let me play devil's advocate just for a second and ask you this. Is there a danger, not necessarily in the IF sort of games, but in gaming in general, is there a danger when you go to make a game more accessible, is there a danger that you cause problems for other users, maybe even making the game too easy or even giving them some disadvantage?
So, no. There's no danger. I mean, you have to do everything smart. You have to be smart with what you're doing. So giving them a disadvantage, that's interesting. There are some games now that exist that were written, I think, mostly by blind developers that are sound-based, where there's I can't remember what it's called. There's a mobile, basically sort of FPS-style game, where it's entirely dark screen and you're navigating based on the sound that you hear. And I actually can't play it at all. I've tried it. It's really quite difficult. So it's, you know, like, yes, actually. And that's a fascinating way to say, hey, like, look at this balance. There are games that are optimized for different abilities. One of the things that's big in the disability community is this thing called the social model of disability, which I don't want to get too much into because it's a distraction, but the idea is that it's not that people can't do things, is the world is optimized for a certain type of abilities. And if you take something like a game that's all audio, which of course is not accessible to everyone, it's not accessible to people with hearing disabilities, for example, but that makes it clear that a game that's all audio can make it clear that this is absolutely a social model. We have games where, you know, we assume vision but we don't have games where we assume you're necessarily going to be navigating by sound, because this is based around the abilities that most game players have. Mm-hmm. As far as, you know, making things too easy, you can make things optional. So again, the example that I brought up earlier, which is real-time combat. This is a very personal one for me, which is why I bring it up. I can't play games with real-time combat. I absolutely would love to sit down and, you know, play through Dragon Age on my own, but I can't do anything at the speed of real-time combat. Now, all you do is you make it an option. Do you want to switch to turn-based combat or not? And it doesn't make things too easy for other players, because they can turn on that option or not, depending on what they want to do. And again, if you have leaderboards, you just adjust your leaderboards to accommodate you either have weighted leaderboards or you have different leaderboards or something like that. But as long as it's an option. One of the great examples that I see, this is a small thing. There's a game, a mobile game called Two Dots, which is pretty popular. And it's just a puzzle game. And Two Dots has a colorblind mode. And it's a toggle. You turn it on or off. And they instituted it for colorblind people. They did because it's a color-based puzzle game. And that's why they put it there. But I've seen a lot of people on social media talking about how, oh, it was late at night and my eyes were tired, so I turned on colorblind mode. It was great. Or like, oh, my screen was having problems, so I turned on colorblind mode. So you can put options in, and people use them or not, depending on whether they need them.
Interesting. Interesting. I think this next question will probably go back to Jason. Let's talk about copyright in some of these old games. There's a concept that I've heard a lot about thinking about old games, and that's abandonware. And it's games that are not published anymore. They're really old. Hardly anybody plays them, but the copyright hasn't expired on them. Is this something that you get looking at the old IF games? And how does IFTTF handle this? What's their approach?
That is a good question, and I am obliged to begin by saying I am not a lawyer.
Nor do you play one on TV.
No, IFTTF does have legal counsel, and as the organizer of the IF competition, this is actually a real question. And I spent some time earlier this year going over the competition rules and tightening up the wording specifically on our rule regarding copyright. So as far as copyright of older works and works that especially, I mean, when you talk about abandonware, you're specifically talking about works that are long out of publication. For example, everything that Infocom ever made. I believe that the official stance of the IF community right now, like the archive, is that the works themselves are not put into the archive if any copyright holder could at some point come forward and say, no, we own that. The community respects that. But there are like public domain versions of some of the truly classic works, like the original Colossal Cave and Adventure that has a variety of public domain implementations and some of which are open source that are completely explorable. But yeah, a lot of the work that came out in the 80s and such is in sort of a gray zone. One way that we approach this with the IF competition, which is one of IFTTF's public programs right now, is that we encourage we encourage people to exercise fair use. The way that fair use is currently interpreted with U.S. copyright law, which is to say you can mix in elements from a work that you don't own the copyrights to so long as you make a transformative work out of it. So, for example, in your entry, you cannot just take a painting or a song that you like or several paragraphs from a book or a game and just quote them straight up. You can take this stuff and overlay it and remix it in interesting ways to create something brand new. So what I suppose I'm getting around to is that I've been thinking about copyright in IF lately, particularly as it regards creativity and making new things. When we talk about copyright and access to older work, that continues to be a thorny issue. I should admit that it is not difficult to find copies lying around that have fallen off the back of a truck on the internet of old games if you wish to play them. I don't think you'll find them in the archive, in the IF archive per se, except in those cases where for one legal reason or another, including public domain or Creative Commons and such, they are legally allowed to do so. I will point out that one of the rules of the IF competition that was put in very early is that every work, the authors agree to have it placed into the IF archive forever. Since this year is the 22nd annual interactive fiction competition, that's a lot of IF games that the copyright belongs to the owners, but because they've agreed to make them freely playable forever, you can freely play them. And a lot of them are, there's 22 years of history right there. And that's something that the community is rightfully proud of.
So have all those games been put under like a Creative Commons license?
If only. if individual works. So the funny thing about interactive fiction is that every work is a piece of software. And if the creator chooses to put it under a Creative Commons license, they can do so. That's actually a really good question, because I think the Creative Commons people get cranky if you say, can I put my software under it? They're like, no, you shouldn't do that because it's not for software. But it's actually a lot of written text. Can I put the prose of my game under Creative Commons? Oh, maybe. But it has all this also business logic that actually drives the game forward. And it can get really interesting. I think for my own work that I've open sourced, I'd have to go look, but I think I may have just used the MIT license for that, because that is very easy and loosey-goosey. It just says, here is a license, go nuts. I retain copyright on it, but you can do whatever you want. That is not actually the MIT license. It's worded a lot better than that, and I don't mean to represent it, excuse me. But it's very short. You should read it.
Sure. So we did get a question from the chat room that ties into this. How often have people interactified classic works of literature as contest entries? This comes from Steve Dorries. And I was thinking about this, too, with the rise of things like Pride and Prejudice and Zombies taking an old work. Do you get things like that as part of the competition?
The first thing I think of actually is not a competition entry, but it has appeared in the competition prize pool. So another way that people can interact, if you will, with the IF comp is as prize donors. We have a prize pool that anybody can pledge prizes into, and at the end of the competition, the prizes are distributed to the winners, with the first place authors getting the first pick, and so on. I know that the Canadian author and humorist Ryan North has written a number of modern choose your own adventure books based on Shakespeare. I believe he is the author of Romeo and or Juliet. I could be wrong, and that is actually somebody else. I know that he wrote a book about Hamlet a year or two ago. I know that on this year's competition, somebody wrote a game that is a pastiche of Edgar Allan Poe. In the past, there have Graham Nelson, who is the creator of Inform, which is one of the more popular toolkits for creating IF, adapted Shakespeare's The Tempest into a parser fiction. The literature, just by the fact that it's made out of the same stuff, it's made out of text, is absolutely a rich mine for people to create interactive experiences out of.
Okay, interesting. What's that? Go ahead.
If I can add to that, one thing that another interaction between literature and interactive fiction that's been happening in the last few years that's really interesting is people who are creating interactive fiction games as a form of fan fiction. So there's a huge annual fan fiction competition every year at the end of the year called Yuletide. And for the last several years, people have been writing works of fan fiction as interactive fiction games as their entries, and they've actually all been mostly been very, very popular using these same tools, so that these are, you know, it's not pre-existing literature, but it's people who are taking an existing art form, which is the form fan fiction of, like, here's the genre and here's the rules of this genre, and saying, but I want to produce this text, this thing in the genre of fan fiction, I want to produce it as a crossover with this other genre, which is interactive fiction. And it's been a really interesting sort of a evolution watching that grow.
Oh, that's interesting. So not to steal too much from the show to come in a couple of weeks, but is there a open source IF engine that then uses some sort of a scripting language just for IF games? Is that something that exists, or do each of these sort of stand alone?
There are several, and they exist in various states of open source or notness. The one that you were just obliquely referring to is Twine, which its creator, Chris Clemmis, who is also a co-founder of IFTTF, will be speaking about on this show in December, I think. That is a traditional Floss project, top to bottom. IFTTF's relationship with that is actually based in largely on the Pearl Foundation's relationship with Pearl, in that it's not the steering committee for the project itself. The project itself is autonomous in a flossy sort of way, but it is helping out with a sort of universe of stuff and support that helps keep the Twine project alive and moving forward. So yeah, there is Twine. Another system I mentioned earlier Twine is specifically for making hypertext and choice-based interactive fiction. And when you are working with Twine, it is a toolkit that helps you make things at the lowest level. You're working with JavaScript and HTML and CSS. Your output is a website. But it is a toolkit that makes it very easy for, and this is very important, people who do not know JavaScript and are able to make interactive experiences with no particular coding knowledge at all. And then with the community of Twine developers and the advantages of the toolkit itself, as you get good at it, just like any other artistic skill that you pick up, you can start learning various tools and techniques and tricks that you can then apply to your game to make add animation or add multimedia and things like that to make to make the IF that you have in mind. The other one I mentioned earlier was Inform, which is a very long-lived project initially started by Graham Nelson. He still leads the project with a small team of other people. That is sort of mixed in the open source realm. Its current version is Inform 7, which is a fascinating to work with natural language-based language. So you can program in it. Like, the source code for a very simple Inform 7 game would be like, the office is a room. The player begins play in the room. The player is wearing a hat. There is a cat in the room. The description of the room is ba-ba-da-ba-da. That's a terrible game, but it would probably compile with a little bit of tweaking and actually be a playable text adventure game. Inform 7 is based on a very complicated tool chain that has evolved over the last 20 years. It compiles down to Inform 6, which is entirely open source, and you can find that on GitHub. Some of the 7's compiler, and I think its IDE, are closed. But the tech that it is based on is open. So that's sort of a mixed semi-floss example. And what's also interesting is a lot of the works themselves are case by case, if the authors choose to do so, made open source. So while Inform 7 is not entirely open, one of the most involved games ever made with Inform 7 is the game Counterfeit Monkey by Emily Short. This game is, the source of it is entirely available online, and it is browsable on GitHub. And it is, if you've never seen Inform 7 source before, or even if you have, I very much encourage you to browse the source, because it is amazing just to read as a work of source. It is also amazing to play through.
I can already tell that we could probably go on for a second hour here, but I don't have a second hour on the live slot. So I do need to start wrapping up here, but I do want to get your reaction to my solution to the original adventure game. We had a binary that was compiled, I guess, from the Fortran sources, the original sources, on a PDP-11. And I think it was running RISC-C or whatever back then. And but I realized that it read a text file for the descriptions, and I was getting really frustrated by the maze, because I would keep dropping things and then losing track of which path went to which path to get to the things that I dropped there. So I went in with a text editor and added the room number to every single description, essentially modifying the goalposts, and that made it so much easier. What do you think of that?
It sounds like you solved the puzzle. Good job. Seems legit. Yeah. I have no problem with the solution.
Randall T. Kirk.
Yes, Randall T. Kirk. Right, Randall Kobayashi, Kobayashi Maru with a game that really didn't deserve it. Actually, but the thing is, Kobayashi Maru is when it doesn't have a solution at all. And this did have a solution, just longer than I wanted. But that's sort of the way I play all these sort of puzzle games. Anyway, I sit and buy the cheat book or Google the cheat walkthrough and walk through all those. So again, we could talk forever. We're almost out of time. And we will be covering Twine in an upcoming show. We'll talk more about that when the schedule actually gets added. Is there anything we didn't cover other than Twine that you want to make sure our audience is aware of about the IFTIF and the IFComp for today's show?
Either yeah, sure. I guess just as a wrap up for how all these we've talked about a wide variety of topics and just how all they meet together and why Deborah and I are here together in the first place is so IFTIF is again a charitable nonprofit. It is registered in the United States as a 501c3. So all donations are tax deductible. We're allowed by law. And we have again three public projects. We run the interactive fiction competition. We run the sort of Twine committee, and we are in the coming months going to run the IFTIF accessibility testing project, which is a one-off project that will analyze and deliver a report about the state of accessibility all over the IF universe, if you will, and generate a report of recommendations. And that is a project that is coming together right now, and that is what Deborah is heading with a team of experts, and we're really looking forward to that. So we do run on public support, both moral and financial, and if you want to learn more about how you can help in either of these ways, please visit our website at iftechfoundation.org. And we have a mailing list and a Twitter and a Facebook and a blog and all that other good stuff that you'd expect to find.
And cool. Go
ahead, Deborah.
Sorry. And I would like to add that testing project, we're going to be having volunteers do the testing. We're going to be training the volunteers how to do the testing. And so if you'd like to get involved, either because you'd like to improve the state of the IF tools world, which is a wonderful reason, but also if you just want to be trained in how to do accessibility testing, this is a great way to do it. Let us know and we will involve you, and we would love for interested volunteers who wanted to help us test the state of all of the accessibility of interactive fiction tools that are out there.
Awesome. And two more questions for each of you, because my audience will yell at me if I don't. And actually, I might get some good answers this time. We'll see. So for each of you, the questions are going to be, what is your favorite scripting language and what is the text editor you spend all day in? We'll start with Jason.
I think I'm going to disappoint you by how pedestrian these answers will be, but I think you and I are in the same business, Merlin, in that we're, if I can call you that,
yes.
In that, yeah, our day jobs are software consultants, and I am on the show because I answered your call at Yapsi. So my general purpose programming language of choice is Perl. That's what I've been
Yay!
Working in.
Yay!
Yeah.
Okay. Yay!
That's what I've been working in since the late 90s. I think the community is great, and I work in other stuff too. The most recent IF I wrote was in Python. For day-to-day work, it is Perl. And what do I use for a text editor? If I happen to be typing in stuff, get ready to cheer again, Randall, over a SSH connection, I use Emacs.
Yay! Oh, okay.
But if I'm working locally, I use BBEdit, which I know is pretty weird, but I've gotten really comfortable with it on my Mac.
That's decent. I know the guy who wrote that, so it's not bad. It's a good thing. Let me go ahead and let Deborah answer her questions first, and then we'll come back.
Okay, well, Deborah? I'm actually pretty pedestrian as well. I'm in Vim all day as my editor, which is a little bit weird because, so I use Dragon Naturally Speaking. I have hand disabilities. I use Dragon Naturally Speaking to talk to my computer, and there is a very small set of editors that work great with Dragon Naturally Speaking. None of them are great for code. They are not great for coding. And you can do a lot of work to make them better for coding, but I've been a Vim Power user since puppies were the oldest animals. So I just am perfectly happy there. For language, I tend to, for small things, I mean, when you say scripting, at the base level, basically here's where I start. For the smaller things are, I start to get these more and more complicated bash pipelines where I'm like, oh, I'm going to pipe this through cut, through sed, through awk, through grep, like a million times, and then suddenly there's the point where I break and I have to use a language, at which point it's Perl or Python, depending on a lot of things. If I'm text parsing, it's Perl. If I'm XML parsing, it's Python. And if I'm not doing either of those things, then it depends what mood I'm in.
Cool. Okay. That's good. Good answers. And just real quickly, Jason, again, we're almost out of time, but I just want to know, have you, since you're an Emacs user, have you ever walked through the Done application inside Emacs?
The Dun application. No, I don't think I'm familiar with this work.
MetaX DUN carriage return. It's a full text adventure built into your Emacs.
Oh, I think I have played that, but it was so long ago I forgot like how to summon it up. Does that have like a bear in it? Like there's like a bear.
Yeah.
To feed the bear to get past the bear. Yeah, I did that. I don't know if
it has two endings depending on what you get in the middle for some sort of random number generator that it generates, which is sort of weird. So it's kind of cool. I only know that because I walked through the walkthrough because I got tired of trying to figure
it out. We do encourage all IFComp authors to upload a walkthrough alongside their work so that people can actually finish them.
Please.
So we don't believe in cheating here in the modern IF world. We just want you to play the games and enjoy them.
I want to see your creativity. I don't necessarily want to be stuck all day in a puzzle going, well, now what do I do? Anyway, hey guys, thanks. Jason and Deborah, thank you for coming on the show today. And like I said, we could have gone another hour easily with everything that's on here. I might have to do a full show just on accessibility because it sounds like there's a lot of material there that is really useful. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having us. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Awesome. That was Jason McIntosh and Deborah Kaplan talking to us about IFTTTF and interactive fiction in general and accessibility and all sorts of things. What do you think, Jonathan?
Oh, it was kind of a nostalgia trip in some ways because, you know, we all played at least a little bit of text adventure games back in the old days or, you know, our younger years. So that was certainly interesting, and it's good to see that people are even still making them. I will have to go and check out their database and see about playing through a few of them. And then the comments about accessibility were very interesting. I hadn't ever thought of the idea of these text interactive fiction games being some of the most accessible, but it does make sense. And just to hear some of the viewpoint on that was kind of enlightening. So some good stuff.
Really cool. And I also want to say for our audience that the IFComp stuff, at least for the last few years that I happen to poke at, are all playable online. So if you want to see this year's competition and even become one of the people who helps vote to say what's the best interactive fiction, go check it out because they're all playable. And some even have a walkthrough. I did actually scroll down. I saw some walkthroughs. So that was pretty cool. Again, we're almost out of time, so let me go ahead and wrap up the end of the show here. So we will have no show next week. I will be on a cruise ship somewhere off the coast of the Mexican Riviera, as they call it, which is the Baja, South Baja, California. I'll be actually docked in Mazatlan on the day we normally tape the show, but I will not be here. I'll be in some sun, which is really great compared to the storm we had in the Pacific Northwest the last few days. I'm really glad to get out there and get up to 80-degree temperatures again. Next week after that, we'll have Chick Tech, which is dedicated to retaining women in the technology workforce. MetaBrains, which is about community-maintained databases, which you might have heard of through the Music Brains project, which is sort of their flagship thing. Oh My ZSH, tools for managing your ZSH config. Zalando, which is a fashion platform with 19 million users, has open sourced some of their sub projects. We'll talk about the relationship between Zalando and why they chose to open source some of their infrastructure. gRPC, which is Google's remote procedure call interface, allows you to do service discovery, high availability, and a bunch of other things that are really cool. We are, again, Twine should be pretty short after that. We don't have the specific date yet, but it will be on. Also, MongoDB is going to revisit us after a six years that we haven't had them on. They've been very busy, not here. A bunch of other people on the short list. If you go to twit.tv/floss, the homepage for this show, you'll see the ones we're working on. If you have a project that's not on that list, like on the chat room they mentioned earlier, The way to get them on is to have the project leader email me, merlin@stonehenge.com. My email address is there. We do a live stream 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Tuesdays, typically at live.twit.tv. You can ask questions and interact with us on that level. Just about to start opening up Q1 in terms of scheduling guests. You can follow us at Floss Weekly and Google Plus and on at Floss Weekly on Twitter. You can also follow me at MERLYN on Twitter, and I'm Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus, which is where I originate everything, but I occasionally interact with people on Twitter as well. I have nothing to plug, which makes this part of the message real quick. Jonathan, do you have anything to plug before we get out of here?
As per usual, I don't particularly have anything to plug. It was good to be here today. I enjoyed it.
Awesome, Jonathan, and thanks for stepping in at the last second. And because I'm out of time, we'll see you all again next week on Floss. Not next week, the week after on Floss Weekly.